It is week 35 of the year 2020, and this is Father Roderick to the Max. Welcome back to another episode for my monthly supporters, my patrons, and the community around it. And it is really starting to feel like a community, thanks to especially the flourishing of the Discord community, where more and more patrons are figuring out how to get access to it and are starting to present themselves. So there's a section where you can introduce yourself. We have a Star Wars section. We have a faith section for your questions. And there's just general chat. And I'm sure that we could do so much more over time, but we're just gradually expanding it step by step. But it's a fun place to hang out with people and to get to know some of those listeners that I only know from their screen name when they're commenting during the live shows. So, on this week's show, I even had one of the members of the community, Samuel Varg, on the show. And that was fun because also, technically, it's something I've never been able to do until now, because I, when you normally have a setup with a mixer and you try to do a mix minus, it gets very complicated. Whereas with the Rodecaster, it was a piece of cake. Really not a problem at all to bring in someone in during the show. So I'll probably do that more often in the near future. Because, well, it's sometimes just interesting to hear someone else's expertise and, you know, some fellow geeks. I don't think I'm ever going to do shows where it's like completely based on a guest. Some podcasters do that, but I always felt that if you do that, the show loses its original character because people listen to the show because of the host, his or her opinion or experiences, and then when you bring in someone else, it's almost like you're being introduced to the friend of a friend of you, but you don't know the other guy, and then you're at least at first a little bit, I don't know this person. So you have to be a little bit careful with that, how to introduce new people. And then, of course, also depends on the quality of the conversation. But it is fun to have the ability, the technical ability, to do this quite easily through Discord. So that's a ton of fun. Speaking of the community, there's always banter going on in the chat rooms, and it's fun getting some feedback on my conversations during each show, but also getting some tips. So for instance, Lucas, who's from Switzerland, he's been in a lockdown because of the coronavirus, and so he watched the entire first season of Upload on Amazon Prime, which I reviewed. I spoke about after seeing the first episode a while ago, and he says it is worth watching. It's fun. Also watched Hamilton due to my recommendation and loved it. The music is subject to taste, but the story and the way they did it is phenomenal. I'm constantly telling all my friends and family to finally watch it. True. It's very well done, very well executed, and I heard it was filmed at the height of the popularity of the show. So all the original actors are there, and you can just feel the energy of the performance. So that's pretty cool that Disney brought that. Even though I still think it's a very American story and sometimes very hard to follow if you're not familiar with the recent history of the United States. But it's also an opportunity to go look into that and educate yourself a little bit. Hey, it is time to start with the show. And of course, as usual, we'll start in the kitchen. Today, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite desserts that I always get at least once during my stay in Rome. It is not gelato, even though, of course, when I'm in Italy, I try to get the best gelato. And now that I talk about it, I miss it so much. Oh, the darn coronavirus. We want to go to Rome and have gelato. But No, actually, gelato is more something that I would eat in the evening or after a day's work. But after a regular dinner or even lunch at a restaurant, oftentimes a gelato is too much. It's too much sugar. You've already eaten a full meal. Just puts me to sleep. So I remember the first time that I was sitting at this restaurant in the center of Rome. What was the name of that restaurant? I think I Googled it. I was with a Dutch producer, and she lives in Rome, but she's from the southern part of my country. And because she's been in Rome for 20, 30 years, she knows all the good places to eat. And oftentimes when we have a meeting, for instance, I'm filming like a couple of episodes there, she has worked beforehand to find me guests or do suggestions. And so we always have a meal in the evening or a lunch just to kind of catch up. And I mean, after all, she's one of my collaborators. And so she brought me to a restaurant called Polese. I think it's Trattoria Polese. And it is very close to the Bridge of Angels. And near the Castle Sant'Angelo, but then on the city side. It's on the road Vittorio Emanuele, so the big shopping street, or it's also a busy road with cars and buses, that leads to this monument near the Piazza Venezia. And on the right side of the road, pretty close to the bridge, you have this little square. It's actually quite a nice area in the busy city of Rome, because it is, there's a little bit of a park and the restaurants are around it. So this trattoria, I'd eaten there before, but they really have a good menu, and it's, you know, it's a little bit on the expensive side. It's not like, you know, like a chic restaurant, but it's slightly above where I would normally eat. But then they have all the real Italian specialties. And I have the menu here online. And so for antipasti, so that's the first thing you eat. They've got carciofi alla romana or carciofi alla giuda. And that is something you don't find anywhere else, as far as I know. So it's, what is carciofi in English? Translate that for me, please. Carciofi is artichokes. So artichokes can be prepared in two ways. One is the one that was used, or still is used, in the Jewish ghetto in Rome. So it was, that usually was a very poor ghetto because the Jews were discriminated against and suppressed in Rome for many centuries, some even forced to become Christians. And so they used, their recipes are all based on very simple food. And so the artichokes, a Jewish way, I've eaten them. Actually, I went to film how they prepared it for one of my shows, and it was delicious. They deep fry the artichokes, actually. Not something I would do myself, but it is very, very tasty. And of course, afterwards you fall into a food coma. But and then there's also carciofi alla romana, so the Roman way of preparing it. And then primi piatti, they've got, it's not a very big menu, but it's all good. It's all very, very good. They've got a soup with broccoli. They've got rigatoni, so it's a pasta con la pagliata. I'm not sure what that is. Gnocchi, which is based on potato flour, I think. I'm not a fan of gnocchi. I'm not sure why, because it's very filling, so normally you don't want to eat anything else. And then for the second round, or what is it? Secondi piatti, they've got polpette, coratella, baccala, coda alla vaccinaria. This is stuff that you'd never get in tourist restaurants, because most tourists don't know what it is, and so they don't want to, you know, cervello fritto con I carciofi. What do you think that is? That sounds delicious, but if you know what it is in English, I don't think many tourists will go for that. Cervelli, fried brain with artichokes. I'm not kidding you. Fried brain. No. I'm all for a local food, but I've had cooked brains once in France, in the south of France, but no. They also have oxtail and tripe. Tripe, that's basically intestines. Meatballs and tomato sauce. Now that sounds like a safe option, but it's also the most boring dish they serve. Although the meatballs are very good. They've got lamb and they've got codfish. And that's it. At least this is for the specialties, of course. And then they have the regular stuff as well, of course, because they don't want to miss out on the tourists. So you can get your spaghetti with, aglio olio or the penne arrabbiata spaghetti with anchovies and tomato sauce and, the classic dishes. But you can eat that anywhere. What they also have, and that is something you don't get much, is this dessert. And I love it. It's not even on the menu, I notice. This is something you have to know that they serve it. And so this lady, my producer in Rome, she said, because I picked gelato, and normally they get torta, so it's basically cake. And I'm not a fan of Italian cake. It's too heavy. They usually get coffee with it. It's never really appealed to me. So I went for a gelato, and then she said, let me stop you there. What you really need to get here at Polese is sgroppino. And she said, I'm not going to tell you what it is. I'm not going to tell you the ingredients, but I'm sure you'll love it. And just wait and see. So sgroppino. That sounded like something big, I was like, oh, sgroppino. Maybe it's with, ice cream and then whipped cream and chocolate, maybe sgroppino. It sounds so magical. And so a few minutes later, very quickly, the waiter arrives. And I'm so disappointed. It is this tiny little glass, this vertical glass. And it contains a white liquid that looks a bit like yogurt. And there is a straw in it and a leaf of mint as a decoration. It's like, so that's all? That's a dessert? She said, no, taste it. So it had a straw, but also came with a spoon. So I'm thinking, this is probably going to be expensive. It's not much. I'm just going to use my spoon. I'm not going to slurp it in 1 second. I just want to really get my money's worth of bite. So I take a little bit of the top of the sgroppino, and it's ice cold, and it's very creamy. There is definitely gelato in there or something, or sorbet ice. But it also has this bite to it, and it's got this lemon flavor, but there's definitely alcohol in there. But I couldn't really figure out what am I tasting here? What is this? It's an explosion of flavors, and yet it looked just so simple and plain and really tiny, hobbit-sized. But then, oh my gosh, I got so addicted to this. Well, I'm going to tell you how you can make this yourself, and it is so good. The requirements are not your run-of-the-mill stuff, so you may have to go and, buy some stuff before you can make this. But it was so good. Okay, so what do you need? This is for how many people? It doesn't say. I assume 4 people, but I'm not sure. Anyway, this dessert originally is from the Veneto region of Italy, so it's up in the north. It only takes 10 minutes to make, but it needs to chill for 3 hours. So it is ice cold. That's why I love it, because you serve it on a hot day in the summer in Rome, and it can be like 30 to 35 degrees, and then having that just this really nice little light but also very cold dessert. Oh, it's much better than gelato, I would say, as a dessert. You take 12 ounces of lemon sorbet ice. Just get any brand. I just get it from the supermarket here. It doesn't have the milk in it, so it's much lighter. You then also get the a bottle of Prosecco. That's kind of expensive. You need 8 ounces of Prosecco. So 12 ounces of lemon sorbet, 8 ounces of Prosecco, which is this bubbly wine. Very tasty, also very nice on a summer evening. Two, and here it is, this is a secret ingredient, 2 ounces of vodka. Doesn't come across as an Italian recipe, but, well, it is part of the recipe, so 2 ounces of vodka, and then mint leaves for garnish. As any recipe in Italy, super simple. Anyone can make it. So, here's how you make it. You scoop the sorbet into a large metal bowl. It needs to be metal because you're going to mix it around. Then you add one half of the Prosecco, so 4 ounces, and then you whisk it around until the sorbet melts into the wine. It needs to become one consistent mixture. Then you whisk in the vodka and the remaining Prosecco. So you mix it all, and then what you can do is, so it becomes like a very slushy type of drink. And the metal bowl will also spread the ice, the temperature of the ice, to the rest of the mixture. So if you put this in a plastic bowl, it doesn't get the same consistency. I tried. So the metal bowl helps to evenly distribute the cold to the entire mixture. But then what I do, because there is alcohol in it, vodka, you can pour it into a glass. You can use just one of those small glasses, and then you put it in the freezer. And because of the vodka, it won't completely freeze. That's what they do in the restaurant. That's why they can serve it so quickly. You take it out of the freezer, and within a few minutes already, it starts to melt again. And then you have to immediately drink it. Because if it melts too much, it just becomes this drink, and it's not interesting anymore. So it needs to have that chewy consistency. And the mint is just there for the color combination. It's just this mint leaf, the green, and then of course, you need a transparent glass. Sgroppino. It's called Sgroppino. I have no idea what it means. I'm gonna Google that. What is the etymology of Sgroppino? There's an entire entry here in the Italian notebook. Interesting. So, Sgroppino is a lemon-flavored, creamy, smooth, frothy alcohol beverage. It's more a digestive than an aperitivo, a cocktail. It was created by the inventive and masterful Venetians back in the 16th century. So this is from Venice, the 16th century. Sgroppin, as it's called in Venetian dialect, means to untie a little knot. The kind one finds in his or her stomach following a large meal. Wow, that is such a great name. So it's you untie the knot with a sgroppino. In other areas of Italy, it's actually also simply called sorbetto. But I like the idea with the, untie the knot after a heavy meal. Made with milk-free lemon sorbet, and a bit of alcohol, Sgroppino was served in aristocratic Venetian homes during dinner to cleanse the palate between the first and second courses, normally fish to meat. Oh, I did not know that. And to also help digest all that was consumed at the tail end of the dinner. So they would get 2 Sgroppinos. That tradition continues today with a few minor twinks to the centuries-old recipe. Today, the classic Sgroppino is made with lemon sorbetto, vodka, and Prosecco sparkling wine. Variations include strawberry, grapefruit. Ooh, I'm going to try that out. Strawberry, grapefruit, or mandarin sorbetto. With lemon, and for some, the addition of limoncello. Oh, no, that's not a good idea. Limoncello, that is way too sweet. It's too sugary. There's already a lot of sugar in the sorbet. So you don't want to add extra sugar. I think that's overdoing it. But anyway, for some people, any excuse that helps them to drink more limoncello is welcome. But I like my limoncello in a small glass that comes straight from the freezer. It's also wonderful on a late evening. So there you have it. One of my favorite Italian desserts, sgroppino. And now you know what to order and where to go if you ever visit Rome. One of the usual ingredients of this show is a piece about the liturgy, because there's a lot actually that I take for granted, and I'm familiar with it because I grew up in a Catholic environment, but for many others may be puzzling and mysterious, and they would like to hear a little bit more about the meaning of all the symbolism and the rituals and how churches look and that sort of stuff. So that's why I started this liturgy segment. And if you have any questions about that, if you see something, for instance, during Mass for Geeks, and you're wondering where does that come from, what is the meaning of that, by all means, ask me on Discord and I can answer it here. Because I often don't realize the things that are very strange to someone because, well, again, I grew up with it. So currently, when it comes to liturgy, we're still working really hard in the church that I use for streaming, the St. Joseph's Church, next to which I live, actually, refurbishing it, making it more beautiful. This church was built 100 years ago. And then in the 60s, during the reforms, this one priest decided to paint the entire church white, cover all the paintings, remove almost everything. So it looked boring. Very, very boring. Now that we're back in a visual age, and I'm using that church as the background for my streaming masses, I want it to look nicer and have more details. And so we're on an ongoing quest to add back some of the stuff that they threw away in the 60s, which is hard because they literally threw it away. They destroyed the statues of the saints that were on all the pillars. They just dumped it. They wanted to cover the floor under the altar with a somewhat higher platform. And so before they poured in the cement, they dumped in there all the stone statues. Ha! Hand palm. Seriously, that's what they did. And you can't recover them. They painted the paintings surrounding the altar with white, the cheapest paint that they could find. There is actually currently a painter, a professional painter in the church, and he's restoring the entrance of the church, which hadn't been repainted for many years. And so, well, he's not doing any designs, but I asked him about the original paintings, and he said, "Yeah, I remember that. I was very young when they did that, and we were all in shock." Because we loved all those images, and it was, you know, all of a sudden the church looked so empty and unfinished. And he said, "Now that I am a professional painter, I also know what they did. And unfortunately, they used the kind of paint that you can't remove anymore. If they had used a different type of paint, then maybe we could have washed it off and resurfaced the original designs. But we can't anymore. The only thing left of that era are black and white photos." So that's still on my wish list is to bring in another artist and to have that person redesign the walls or re-add paintings. This church clamors for more design and for, you know, more illustration. But we're going to do this step by step. For me, the most important thing to work on right now is the altar. This church had various altars in the past. Of course, you had the high altar, which was fixed to the wall. They completely removed it and destroyed it. It was probably made with marble. On the photos, it looks very nice, but it was also very pompous and at one point was considered to be you know, too much. So they destroyed it and threw everything away. The result is that the wall against which you had the high altar, which facing east, was now completely empty. And in the past, next to the high altar, they used to have curtains. So it added color, it added warmth. It also improved the acoustics. They also removed all the curtains. So what remains is this white wall. And I'm thinking, why such a missed opportunity? And when we were starting to renovate things, one of my first wishes that I expressed was, can we please bring back the high altar? Not because it has a specific liturgical function, but because the church was built for that. And if it's not there, something is missing in the logic of the architecture. So let's bring back the high altar. Let's use some elements of the existing furniture, because I like to always integrate the past in the new. That's one of the big issues that I have with this. All these changes in the 60s, they just painted over it. They completely disregarded previous generations and the work of all these artists, and they thought they knew much better. But so what we're doing right now, or currently someone is working on this, is they're taking the main altar that's very recent. It was it was a very cheap wooden altar in the 80s, but it was small and it was cheap. It really didn't look very pretty. And then a woodworker here, or a carpenter, was also a volunteer in the parish and said, I'm just going to build a new altar. And then they had someone from the diocese, no longer working for the diocese. And he had all sorts of very specific ideas of what the church should look like. Not all in good taste, I should say. And then together with the carpenter, they designed a new altar. And they used some of the carved wood panels from the original furniture of the church. Fortunately, a little bit of that was preserved. But then they created this massive, massive, big, chunky, square altar. The church is small. The altar was so big and heavy. It's all made of oak wood. Really good quality, but also way too big. Now that we want to bring back the high altar, we need more space, because otherwise you cannot move around anymore, especially because there's a lot of movement in Catholic liturgy, right? It's the using frankincense to venerate the altar. There's movement of acolytes, priests, deacons. You need room. Well, that one big square altar right in the smack in the middle of the priestly choir is just way too big. And so, and also, it had carved panels on the sides and on the back of the altar, which you can't even see when you're sitting in the church. So the plan now is to make the altar rectangular instead of square, and use the pieces that we take off the main altar to use that as the elements for the high altar. So the high altar in the back will have the same style as the main altar. And so from what I wanted was that from when you're sitting in the church, from that perspective, it should look the same. Well, of course, that always comes with a lot of criticism from people that don't want to change anything. So they fall into the same trap as previous generations. They think that what they know is law and has always been like that. But of course, that's not the case. We're trying to bring back some of the elements from the past and combining it with the new. Whenever you make changes in any society, you will get resistance. It's just part of human behavior. However, I hope that with good explanations and also with just the beauty, the proof is in the pudding, I think that once that's in place, it will look so much more logical and people will understand that, whoa, okay, so that is what you meant. I also would really love to bring back the curtains behind the high altar and to give it a much warmer feel And also to be able to bring back color, because it's all white, and white is not a color. It is just all colors together. So I'm not sure exactly how things are going to look, but I'm very happy that we are finally making changes, that people are motivated to make the church more beautiful. The painter that's currently just doing restoration work, I already can tell that just everything looks new again and pretty, and then I know that people are going to love that. And once you get them interested in supporting you in this effort to make the church more beautiful, I think that will also generate a lot of community feelings. So the church, you give the church back to the people. They can contribute to make it more beautiful. And since they have ownership, they also grow a bigger attachment to the church. One of the biggest mistakes that this priest in the 60s or 70s has made is doing it all by himself. He closed the church. No one was involved. He even hired painters from the other village, which is the stupidest thing you can do. And so everybody hated it. And there are still older parishioners that are frustrated as hell today because their church was taken from them and was ruined by this one priest who's no longer alive. He's not even there anymore. And now we're stuck with his handiwork. So, yeah, you always have to first put the community first, think about, okay, how is this going to improve their experience of the liturgy, the experience of, and also the, how is this going to strengthen the community? And that, but then at the same time, you need to be creative. You have to dare to change things and to propose something new, because if you never taste something new, you will never learn to eat. If I don't give you these recipes, you'll never try them out. You may always eat the same, but I'm trying to challenge you to be adventurous and to explore, and then you can still decide what you like and what you don't like. I don't like everything. You will never see me eat fried brains. Brains. Maybe if I turn into a zombie. But by trying everything, you also discover things that you love and that you're going to cherish for the rest of your life. The same is true for liturgy. It's always in movement. It's like the future, according to Yoda.
Always in motion. The liturgy is.
I recorded too many podcasts today to do an impression of Yoda. But anyway, that's the current state of affairs. I'm going to move you over to the final segment of the show, tech. And that requires this jingle. All right, yeah, I want to talk about technology, and more specifically, I want to give you a brief overview of the gear that I've bought over the years and that I'm using to film my documentaries. As you know, I'm a program, a TV filmmaker, documentary maker. I've been doing this for 3 years now, and I've self-taught. I did study communications in Rome, but and one of my specializations was TV production. But, and so I did learn how to edit, I didn't know how to handle a camera, but that was back in 2001, when digital editing was the newest thing, and these computers just kept crashing, and digital cameras were so expensive. I think we were walking around with a 16,000 euro camera, just for students, and it was huge and heavy, and oh, and the resolution was terrible. It was just SD. You know, even the simplest phone nowadays can do better. But I was excited because I could work with, you know, try to learn how to make television. And I never thought I would actually end up in a job that would involve me doing, you know, making documentaries that would be shown on TV. And that's not the end of my ambitions. My goal for now, my ultimate goal is make stuff for Netflix, you know, real documentaries. I know I can do it. Just have to put my mind to it. But for the time being, I'm on a tight budget. I always travel as light as possible. I never bring extra luggage with me, only carry on. And so I've been gathering small equipment, but high quality equipment, equipment that is easy to use, very versatile, and that can still produce TV quality footage. So, of course, the most important aspect of my gear is my camera. I started with a Sony camera, a camcorder that was able to film in HD, and it had another perk that a lot of other camcorders didn't have. This Sony had built-in stabilization, very, very good stabilization. I could run with that thing, and it would still look as if the camera was on a gimbal. So, well, you couldn't go as far as, you know, you can go now with a real gimbal, but for the time, that was the only camera that could do that. And what it meant was I could film without a tripod, whereas all my colleagues that worked in, you know, professional video production, they would lug around these heavy cameras and even heavier tripods, because the stability, those cameras and those lenses were not stabilized. And so if you want to have a stable picture, you need to put that on a tripod. You can't just, well, some of them would use counterweights on their shoulder, but then a shoulder camera, that makes you so slow and also wouldn't grant you access to many places. If you arrive with a shoulder camera, then they're going to ask for your permit. They're going to ask you to leave. It happens all the time. If you walk around with a little camcorder that looks like a tourist cam, you can do anything you want. That's how I was able to film in the Vatican, in so many places where you couldn't and shouldn't film. I did it anyway because my camera looked like a tourist thingy. And so even though I love that camera, when I look back at the footage that it produced now, I'm thinking, ooh, I can see all the lens defects, and it was, the aperture was not very big, so you couldn't do the fuzzy backgrounds, you know, the bokeh effect, etc. And so I switched to a DSLR. I bought myself a Canon 80D, and a pretty good lens with it. And that became my new go-to camera. It also had a stabilized zoom lens. So I've been walking around with that all over the planet. The only downside is it's heavy. It's very heavy. It's about a kilo that you lug around. So it was twice the weight of the previous camcorder. And I felt it, and I was always on the lookout for, can I go same quality but lighter? And then fortunately for me, the Canon M50 came out. Tiny little photo camera, mirrorless, with a set of pretty good lenses. And I'm still using that Canon M50 today. I may replace it in the near future because Sony has a new camera that is expensive, much more expensive. It's like three times the price of the Canon M50. But wow, it's so good. It's the Sony A73-something. I wrote that down somewhere. I haven't used it yet because it's not available, but I've seen a lot of video reviews. I'm thinking, if I ever going to switch back to Sony from Canon, this may be the camera that will make me want to do it. Where did I write that down? Huh. Let me see. Why are my show notes always such a mess? Oh, it's the Sony A7S III. I think it's about $3,500. And you still have to add VAT. Whoa. Okay, very hefty price, but looks like, a real upgrade to the Canon. However, I'm perfectly fine right now with the Canon. I use the Canon M50 in conjunction with a couple of elements, one of which is a lens, a prime lens. So the Canon M50 comes with a kit lens, which is pretty good and very affordable. But I usually only film with a prime lens, so it's a lens you can't zoom. It's just got one fixture, but it does do autofocus, which is very important for me, and it's very silent. It is the Canon EFM 22mm f2 SDM lens. It's extremely cheap. Sometimes you can get it for $150. The quality is out of this world. The sensitivity, though, the speed of the lens is very fast. F2 For a prime lens, it's just $150. Unbelievable. And actually, 22 millimeters, actually pretty good angle. So you can use that for interviews. You can use it to walk around. The only downside of this is it doesn't have motion compensation. So I use the digital motion balance, or what is it? The motion compensation. and actually, the digital is pretty good. But that's another thing that sets Sony apart. They have it's actually a camera body that has stabilization. So no matter what lens you put on it, it is automatically stabilized. So that saves you a lot of money in the end. But I'm also very good at doing the ninja walk, where you try to not move around too much and you only kind of sneak into scenes to film it. So I've developed a lot of techniques to still normally film without a tripod. Then something that I have bought but haven't tried it out, I'm going to try it out this summer, is an ND filter, a variable ND filter. What an ND filter does is it darkens your lens so that you can still use the maximum aperture. So the aperture is the opening of the lens. The reason you want that opened at maximum, so in this case f2, is that then you get that shallow depth of field, which means you can create blurry backgrounds. The thing is, when it's summer and there's a lot of sunshine outside, there is so much light that you have to close the aperture of the lens, the opening of the lens, otherwise you don't see anything. The image is going to be completely white. When you close the aperture, your depth of field increases. So that means everything is sharp. The foreground is sharp. The background is sharp. For interviews, for most footage that I use, you want that background to be blurry because that separates the person you interview from the background. So that's why you have a variable ND filter. You can kind of turn it. It's very cheap. And it darkens the lens so that you can still use maximum aperture. And also a relatively low frame rate, because that's another way in which you can reduce the amount of light that gets into your camera. It's just up the frame rate. But if you up the frame rate, you go to, 100 frames per second or even 150 frames per second, the image gets very choppy. It gets very stroboscopic. 50 frames per second, that is the frame rate that I use for television, because it results in very natural looking movement, and you want that. Then I do carry around a tripod. However, it is ultra small. I can collapse it into something that's super small, and it is very lightweight because it's made out of carbon fiber. It's a brand that is hard to get in the United States. I think it's German. But there are ways to get it, or you can import it. It's a Rolle, R-O-L-L-E-I, Rolle. And I've got both the C5i and the C5-6. The C6i, is slightly taller. So since I'm interviewing a lot of people from Holland, they're all so tall, they're all giants. And I am a bit of a hobbit. So you always want to have your camera at eye level. So when I know that I'm going to interview tall people, I usually take the C6i because I can get the camera all the way up to eye level. If it's just me in front of the camera, the C5i is tall enough. But they're both really easy to carry around. Then for audio, I use a very small microphone called the Rode Video Micro. Again, cheap, 100 and something bucks. But it's a directional microphone. It takes its electricity from the camera itself. You don't need any battery packs. You plug it into the microphone in of your camera, provided it has one, of course. And then I can use that for any vlogging situation. So if I, for instance, I'm interviewing someone who is showing me around, I'm not going to put a wireless microphone on that person. I just use the microphone on top of the camera, because I also want the microphone to register my questions and my reactions. So that usually works really well in most circumstances. It comes with a dead cat. It's this fluffy little thing that prevents the wind from ruining your recordings. Only downside is it is pretty visible. So what I usually do when I want to film somewhere where I'm not allowed to, I just use the camera and I use the built-in microphone. As soon as I put the camera, the microphone on it, even if it's a tiny little directional microphone, the dead cat immediately alarms people. It signals, oh, this is someone who's making professional, who's doing professional filming. We need a permit. We need money. Problems. So that's the only downside of that microphone. But for most circumstances, it is perfectly fine. I also have a Sennheiser set, both a receiver and a transmitter with a microphone. Next to the camera is the most important piece of equipment, but also the most expensive piece of equipment. I use that for all my interviews. You really want to have sound close to the person. So that comes with, of course, batteries that you need to carry around. But, you know, two of these small pieces doesn't really weigh that much. If you want to go for an even easier to use a solution, I think I can recommend the Rode, the Rode Wireless Lavalier. Let me look that up. What's the precise name? I'm thinking of getting it. The only downside is it's... you can clip it on someone's coat, but it has a pretty prominent Rode logo on it, which for Dutch TV, since it's public TV, is not allowed. So I then need to cover that. And plus, you can really see it. I think you can also use it in conjunction with a lavalier microphone. But then I might as well just use my Sennheiser set. Let me see, video and on camera. That's not it. Studio, it's not mobile, probably mobile. No. It does have here under mobile the SmartLav Plus, which is also something I use occasionally if I want to record my own voice as well. If someone has a lavalier microphone, it will pick up my voice, but I will sound very distant and you need to up the volume and it's not the best way to record interviews. So I use the SmartLav Plus, which is about $80, I think. And you can use it with any phone, and then you just use the built-in recording app. But it records pretty good, you know, quality audio. And then later on, I can mix that into the final edit. Can't find it. Is it transmitters? Oh, here it is. Oh, it's called RodeLink, I think. No. What? Okay, now I'm puzzled. Why is that so hard to find? It's one of their best-selling sets right now. Kits? Oh, there you go, finally. Wireless Go. It's called Wireless Go. It comes in black or white. It's an ultra-compact digital wireless microphone system. Unique in its clip-and-go versatility, incredibly compact form factor, unmatched price accessibility. Perfect wireless mic situation for content creators in all disciplines. Vloggers, etc. Yeah, I definitely need to get me one of these. But anyway, if I don't have to buy new stuff, I don't, because I try to do everything on a shoestring budget. But this definitely seems like something that is also a bit more weatherproof than what I use for Sennheiser. Anyway, and then I have some extra stuff that is brand new and that I'm also going to use, because this year I'm going to film myself on a bike and I'm going to film other people on while I'm riding my bike. Now, of course, I can't carry around a real camera. Even the M50 would be too dangerous to carry around on a bike, and it will probably not yield good results. So there are two ways in which I can do this. I can use my phone, my Zenfone 6, in combination with the DJI Osmo Mobile 3. That is actually a gimbal, a plastic gimbal, but still very sturdy. Works really well, cheap, very affordable, and it's DJI, so it's still very good quality. The downside is that is still pretty big to hold on a bike. And if I drop it, I may damage my phone, and the phone is not cheap. So the second solution is to use the DJI Osmo Pocket, and that is a tiny little camera. Actually, it's one of those cameras that they also use in drones. It's very lightweight, and it's mounted on a gimbal that is as tall as my hand, and that's it. Very lightweight, good battery power, and it films in 4K if you want. The only downside is the aperture is not that big. But since I'm going to be filming outside most of the time, I don't think that's going to be an issue. I also bought a little wide-angle lens for it, clip-on, so it's magnetic. And that made it actually even very useful for vlogging, because normally the lens was pretty much zoomed in, so you had to really keep it, stretch your arm, and then still, it's too close to the camera. With a wide-angle lens, that is less of a problem. So I'm going to use the DJI Osmo Pocket to film while I'm riding my bike. And then I have one final device that I'm carrying around, also super tiny. And if you're in the chat, I can show it to you. And it's this little drone. It is the DJI Mavic Mini. I bought it just very recently. I haven't tried it out yet. It's got the camera. It's super light. I can't believe it almost looks like a toy. And it's so tiny. You can carry around this drone in your backpack. I wish I'd had this during my trip to Santiago de Compostela. I would have made so many drone shots. I got the extra battery pack, and some comes with some extra stuff that is very useful if you want to use it all day long. And I'm going to film, like an entire day, maybe even do two interviews per day. So if I have additional batteries, because this will fly on one battery, will fly for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, I think. So now I have two. This is also very limited in what it can do. It can't track you. It can't follow you like the Big Brothers. But it's a drone, 4K, very acceptable results. Hey, it's better than nothing. I can climb a tree, but that's more work than just flying a drone. So there you have it. That is literally everything I have that I use to film my TV shows. So let's put some prices on this. Canon M50, $600, $650, including the kit lens. The Canon EFM 22mm, it's about $150. If you look around, variable ND filter, $30. Rode Video Micro, I don't remember, $120, just a guess. The Mavic Mini, so the drone, was $389, something like that. So under $400. The Osmo Pocket was, that's a long time ago that I bought one. I think it's around $200. Maybe there are usually deals for this. Let me see price. How much is that one? Oh, it's $349. So that's actually pretty hefty for such a small device. And I haven't used it that much so far, but hopefully now with the biking, I'll be able to get my money back in a certain way. The carbon fiber tripods are also kind of on the more expensive side. Carbon fiber is always more expensive, so that it would be $150, I guess. Let me look that up for you. I was right. That's about $150. The C6 is a little bit more expensive, but also often on sale. And they also look very cool. The Zenfone 6, I think the Zenfone 7 is right around the corner, so I'd wait for that one. This one was about $500, still less than half of an iPhone. And it's pretty good. I'm very happy with that phone. Has amazing battery life. 3 days! 3 days of battery life! Beat that, Apple! And then the DJI Osmo Mobile, bought that one for $100, for under $100. And the Smart Lav is $70, I think. So add it up. I didn't do the calculation, but if you compare this And if you consider that I can do full-fledged documentaries with this, TV quality, and this is definitely one of the best sets you can buy. Maybe I should just do a list with Amazon links. So if you're an aspiring filmmaker, you can help me get some money back from Amazon. I'll see if we can make a list of this with some affiliate links. But anyway, there you have it. That's what I work with. And it took me a long time to figure out what would work the best. But after having worked with some of this equipment, I wouldn't want to change it for the world. And I certainly don't ever want to go back to these big cameras, because the lighter you are, the simpler you make it, the more you can focus on creativity. That's all for today. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks for being a sponsor. And I will talk to you soon. Take care.